From the boardroom to the locker room, sport captures the imagination like little else. In this podcast, we talk to the men and women who make the big decisions and those who make the big plays to find out where sport is and, importantly, where it's going. But we do so through the only eyes that matter, those of the fan.
Welcome, everybody, to another edition of Are You Not Entertained? You'll have realised that our colleague Grant Williams isn't with us today. I think he's gone off the grid, as he sometimes does. But we've got the captain, Giles Morgan, with us at the start of season three of what has become quite a little podcast in its own right. And I'm delighted to say we've also got a new sponsor for season three of The Big Interview, Pump Jack Data. How are you, Captain?
I am on belting form. My holiday between season two and season three, which was, I think, 6.5 days, has been exhausting. And I'm ready to go now. We've got cracking guests ahead. It's an exciting time to be in this industry.
It certainly is. It's. I was thinking, well, you know, what is season three going to be for us? Because I'm a great believer that you have to keep moving content on. I don't think you can keep it still. And there's some real interesting ideas around. James and I have been talking a little bit about interactivity and live shows, which I'm sure we'll talk about between us. And then also, I don't know what you think, Giles, but I get a lot of people coming up saying, love the show. However, you know, you got to get beyond the 50 plus white man thing. And, you know, get some ideas out there about younger participants to maybe do a show under the banner, a little bit like yourself and maybe Andy Nicol coming on, just giving a different perspective. You know, this platform's going to grow in season three, Giles.
Yeah, well, listen, I think we got to keep things changed up, Rog. And I think this platform that's been built up over the last 3 years is becoming a bellwether, really, for the sports industry in a lot of markets around the world. It's growing. And I think the more guests that we can have that reflect the changing pace of the sports industry is going to be very exciting for our existing listeners. We want to build the listener base, of course, and always welcome. And we really do encourage listeners to come in and tell us, whether it's be through social media or direct via email, tell us what they think and what they need to hear, because this is an industry in total revolution. And therefore, we've got to reflect that change as it's happening, which is happening almost on a weekly and monthly basis. So, yeah, more interactivity would be good fun. I'd like to see you under the pressure of live podcasting. I think that would get you really sweaty. And let's see what we can, what other shows
we can do. I'm pretty certain I've got more live broadcasting experience than you have back in the old SPL days, which I agree with you is not pleasant. Although, as an older man now, I do think it could be quite interesting to just throw a grenade in when nobody can edit it out. I think that could be incredibly interesting.
Roger, I know you have a lot of experience when you were appearing on a lot of broadcasts in black and white and on the wireless. So things have moved on. So let's see where this goes.
So listen, let's get on to today's show, which is the start of season three, I think. You couldn't start it in any better way. So I'm going to ask you, Gilo, to introduce for the listeners who is on The Big Interview this week.
Yeah, well, you're right. Season three, we wanted to start big, and big we have. This is a humdinger of a guest, and I think anybody in the sports industry would be well worth listening to the words of Sir Martin Sorrell. Sir Martin has been at the vanguard of really the global media industry since the mid-70s. He worked for a while with Mark McCormack at IMG and, of course, at Saatchi & Saatchi's. But in 1986, he then set about building WPP into the world's largest media group and was at the helm there for 30 years and I think the longest serving ever FTSE 100 CEO. In 2008, he created S4 Capital, which is a radically different type of media company. It's exclusively focused on digital and embracing the new technology and the media platforms that drive D2C for their clients. Ever since I was a wee boy, and that's going back a bit, Martin has always been very vocal and very, very passionate about the power and influence of sport on the global media landscape, and himself is a passionate follower of Formula One and cricket. What you can't find on his biography anywhere, or on LinkedIn, or on his CV in general, is that he also has the dubious distinction of captaining me on the cricket field on a number of occasions when his own team was woefully short of a bowling attack. Whilst I may not have picked up too many wickets for him, I was spectacular in the tea interval, launching myself with gusto into the outstanding cake tray. Sir Martin Sorrell, welcome to the big interview.
Thank you, Giles. Thank you.
Well, we wanted to throw you straight into the Gladiators arena. So firstly, let me introduce you to my co-host, the very pugnacious and Caledonian Roger Mitchell. He's been champing at the bit to ask you the first question, so I'm going to hand over.
Can't wait, Roger. Go ahead.
Nice to meet you, Sir Martin.
Good to meet you.
Well, pugnacious, not really, but what I think I'd like to ask you, having listened to so many of what you've of the interviews you've done recently, I'd like to go to one that I think is the most pertinent insight. The new generations, S4 clearly is kind of like starting afresh in the marketing industry.
Right.
We know that they consume content differently. They want to have it delivered differently.
Yeah.
Do you think sport is in any way ready to deal with such a paradigm shift?
Well, it depends on who you're talking about, I guess. I mean, there are some people clearly who get it, and there are some people who don't. I mean, sport tends to be historically, not so much currently, but historically, sports clubs or teams are trophy properties, and they tend to be historically probably they were run by people in the locality, who liked the idea of running a football club. So it was trophy properties of a different kind. And today, you look at, for example, the sale of Roma a few days ago or a few weeks ago, for what looks on the surface a colossal price, certainly in relation to previous transactions or similar transactions, and you realize that it's become big business. But having said that, often the people who are buying them for similar motives, this sort of trophy property motive. So you have this sort of distinction between professional and sort of willing amateur or a willing semi-professional. So there's always been these tensions in sport, from what I've seen. It's become much more professionalized, and therefore, over time, I worked for Mark McCormack for a few years in the late 60s and early 70s. That's 1960s and early 70s, so a long time ago. And Mark was one of those people who actually came in for a fair amount of criticism, I guess, from some quarters for professionalizing sport, but my view took the right path. But he was one of the original protagonists, I guess. But it's obviously moved on a lot since then. So having understanding what S4 stands for, in the area of digital only, Holy Trinity model, which takes first-party data and uses that to create digital advertising content and then pumps that out programmatically, faster, better, cheaper, faster about agility, better understanding 20 or so tech companies, understanding how they perform and relatively, etc., and absolutely, and then cheaper being efficient, and then finally a sort of unitary structure, maybe not as relevant, but the first three certainly very relevant to understanding how you make sufficient return on these expensive investments that are being made. So I think inevitably the owners of sports rights or sports properties have to get to understand what we're talking about, what you're talking about, even more so. It becomes of quintessential importance.
And Martin, do you see, I mean, you've seen that since your early years with McCormack, and now particularly as sports going through, as every industry is, a lot of challenge. Are you seeing change in personnel? Are you seeing less of that Blazer Brigade, more professional types taking over sport and getting involved in sport to commercialize?
Yes. Except, you know, you still find people, yeah, because they're regarded as being trophy properties. It's an odd thing, you know. The standards or the variables or the criteria or the way that things are applied or methods are applied tends to be quite sort of various and volatile. You know, if you said to me, well, who's the quintessential, using that word again, example, Bob Kraft, you know, who owns the Patriots and owns a football franchise, I think, in New York as well. I think he's on the committee for the World Cup in America. I mean, he's, to my mind, one of the most, if not the most, professional in terms of developing sports properties. I mean, Bernie Eccleston at Formula One developed Formula One in a way, both you know, as an independent company and as a part of CVC for 10 years or so. But you know, Bernie did it in his own idiosyncratic way. He did it through lack of investment rather than, you know, heavy investment. Whereas I think Liberty is taking much more an investment-led approach, and clearly Chase Carey is a professional and understands the sort of things we're talking about inside out, but is going at it from a completely different view with heavy investment, whereas Bernie watched every penny to the frustration of some, but to give him his credit, you know, he built a very powerful franchise. And ironically, you can link McCormack to Bernie Eccleston. When I was with Mark McCormack in 69 and 70, I think Bernie was still managing a Formula 2 team and, you know, was just starting on his Formula 1 journey. So he did an incredible, in a very different way, he did an incredible job. So he wasn't a member of what you call the Blazer Brigade, I guess, but he certainly does it, or did it, in a very different way to perhaps how some of the other people are approaching it nowadays. But if you said to me, who do I think, in my experience, and I would come across everybody, has done it in the most professional way, I think Kraft with the Patriots is probably the best example.
Talking about Formula One, Sir Martin, I know it's a big passion of yours. I think when Liberty came in, I think they were quite vocal about saying how easy some of the improvements could be around sponsorship, around all the things that are the kind of like sports playbook now. And I think a lot of us thought that was perhaps optimistic. How do you view the transition to Bernie on his own, to then a partner like CVC, and now to Liberty, where, you know, if we look at the sport now, this is a sport that's been dominated for nearly a decade by one team, which is not ideal. Has Formula One moved forward in the last 7 years?
Well, I don't think it really changed very much between Bernie Eccleston and CVC. I think one of the things about CVC was, maybe it was a good thing, but was quite remarkable, is that CVC didn't change Formula One really very much at all. It was still very much Bernie's thing until it was sold to Liberty and Bernie departed or was pushed out or whatever the real story was. You know, I don't think it really changed. I mean, for the 9 years or so I was on the board of F1 under the auspices of CVC, I think the extraordinary thing is that Donald McPherson didn't really change CBC, and Nick Clary really didn't change it materially, and maybe that was a good thing. For whatever reason, they didn't do it. I mean, they had to sell, I think, the Dornier business, the motorcycle business.
Yeah.
They added, you know, the hospitality business, Paddy McNally's business. And they, you know, they did one or two things, and to say there was no change was not the case, but they really left it pretty much as it is. It's Liberty who really changed it. And it's probably too early to say whether you know, it's been changed for the better or not. Certainly the investment has been made and, you know, people have been hired and people have departed. And
yeah.
So they've come and gone. When you look at the numbers, the numbers certainly as a sort of cash producing investment, I don't know, I haven't looked recently. I mean, the market value, if there is a market value for F1, which I'm sure there is, certainly the nominal value from a stock point of view, it seems, you know, it did very well, fell back with COVID and seems to have recovered quite sharply along with other things. So you can't fault what appears to be the market value, although I think it's a pretty thin market. But, you know, it's a brand that obviously has a lot of pull and a lot of enthusiasm at a retail level with individual investors as well as with institutional investors. And I think in the long run will prove to be continue to be a very valuable franchise. But I think the jury's out on whether the sort of liberty revolution has changed things. What you say about the competitive situation, now they've changed with the new Concorde
agreement. Yeah.
They've changed some of the dynamics to make it, quote unquote, more of a level playing field. But, you know, that tends to be the case in Formula One, isn't it? The one or two teams or three teams dominate at the expense of others. And of course, it has become a very expensive sport. And of course, there are also climate issues. You know, the Formula E, I think ironically, with a Malone Liberty investor in it, with I think the controlling interest in it. Ironically, I mean, it was something that Bernie was offered very early on, I remember, at Formula One. And said it would never get anywhere. And I think he's changed his tune. To his credit, he's changed his tune on that. And, you know, I think there were some rumors some time ago about him trying to do something at some stage with Formula E. I mean, I've heard some of the most successful drivers say, you know, when they retire, they might get involved in Formula E as well. So obviously, from an environmental point of view, it offers interesting opportunities, although from a spectacle point of view, there's the obvious problem. But, you know, I just think it's too early to call as to whether the Liberty Revolution has been a good thing, bad thing, or even Stephen.
Let me follow that up and link it to your other personal passion, which is cricket.
Yeah.
One would argue that Formula One and cricket were the two sports that took, in inverted commas, the pay TV dollar and let go the mass market exposure.
Yeah.
The jury is very much out on whether those were good decisions or not. I think cricket certainly was probably more on the negative side rather than positive. But, you know, you were on the board at Formula One and you've been very close to cricket. Going back in time, would you have maintained more of the free-to-air exposure for both of those sports?
Well, it's a very difficult decision because, you know, one is you get short-term certainty of revenue and you lose exposure, you know, with the pay TV. You know, that was very much this decision-making around Formula One, if you like, you know, and going to Sky or whatever, rather than the BBC. Or do you go for, you know, saturation in terms of viewing, but you have less income in the... So I think there are arguments both ways, and it's a very difficult decision to make. I mean, I think generally on sports rights, you know, I would be bullish on sports rights, you know, and not that I would do this, but, you know, I could see somebody saying, I'm sure there's one or two people who do this, that it makes sense, given what you're seeing in relation to your first question, the digital developments and the likely direction of sports rights and sports profit in terms of pricing, it would make sense to form a fund. You know, we should, you know, maybe the three of us should put together, some institutional funding to be a fund that actually invests in companies that do that or directly. Because I think inevitably what's going to happen is these sports rights are going to get more and more fragmented. I mean, it's very interesting that in the sports rights area, the networks, the free-to-air networks, have gone long because they're worried about losing control. So whether you look at the Olympics or the World Cup, the right, and from the rights holder's point of view, it's a much more simplistic thing. You know, I give all the rights to company X or network X, and they get on with it. It demands a much more judgment, you know, as to if you're going to fragment the rights. And I think increasingly that will happen. You know, you're going to see Amazon, well, you already have Amazon and Facebook. You know, Facebook were the underbidder, I think, for the IPL in India, in quite close, my recollection is, to Star, you know, which was a key property. And so, you know, Amazon, Facebook, Google, Tencent, you know, Alibaba are into the Olympic Games. They're a sponsor and they're a top sponsor. So inevitably these platforms, you know, TikTok in whatever form it survives, if it does survive, in whatever form, you know, will be a player too. So all these platforms, you know, all the tech companies, you know, go through them. Google, Facebook, Amazon, Tencent, Alibaba, TikTok, Apple, Microsoft, the Adobe, Oracle, Salesforce, IBM, SAP, Twitter, Pinterest, Snap, Spotify, Netflix, LG, Samsung, all those companies, you know, which are basically the tech universe in which S4 plays, all those companies are going to be involved in one way, shape, or form. You know, we've done
for sure
live programming on a telecoms platform in the US with the NBA. So there's a major. It's really interesting what's happened post COVID or during COVID, but there's a major opportunity that's opened up for us of converting live events to virtual events, and you know. There's some colossal opportunities, whether it be basketball or ice hockey or American football or cricket, you know, I mean, what you can do with streaming on mobile. So I think it's going to change. I think the legitimate question is whether, you know, F1 went too early or, you know, and went ahead too early. Yeah, but there are arguments both ways. I don't think it was a bad decision. I think Sky have done a tremendous job on Formula.
Agreed.
You know, I mean, in terms of fan engagement, viewer engagement. I mean, not to criticize the BBC, but you know, I think they did a really, really good job, and I think that to some extent was needed because the opportunities, the online opportunities, the streaming opportunities, the digital opportunities are huge, particularly for a sport like Formula One.
Well, Martin, we've seen our own pivot moment as well. Are You Not Entertained? And the big interview, which this show is, has now found its first title sponsor with Pumpjack Dataworks. And I know you know about them. And what they're trying to do, as you know, is unearth the most valuable asset in sport, which is just the individual fan and the data that surrounds it. So we have a question for you, which we'll ask all of our guests going forward, is you've been very vocal in the business of sport for 30, 40 years, and you've always, particularly around World Cups and Olympics, equated the two in terms of what was media advertising, etc.
Yeah.
But what is the Sir Martin Sorrell fan passion? What is the sporting event that you go to where the tie may come off, where maybe even the famed BlackBerry, though I suspect you don't have a BlackBerry anymore, I suspect it's...
No, I always take it's now my Apple iPhone with
your Apple iPhone. But even when does that even get muted just a little bit so Sir Martin Sorrell can get lost in the joy of sport?
It gets mooted. Cricket is wonderful because, you know, you can sit there for 5 days from 11 o'clock until about 6 or 7 in the evening, and you can have lunch and tea, and it's wonderful. But, you know, who in this modern day and age can spend 5 days watching? I could, actually. I do enjoy it because, actually, you know, there's enough stoppage time to enable you to do emails in between each ball. I do like the bash and crash of what ODI or T20, but you know, Test cricket to me is, but you know, that's what I was born to, or or brought up to, and I think
we all were.
That's generational.
I remember watching you grind out a half century for your own team. It was about 16 years ago. You batted one. I think your son Jonathan batted two, and the Sorrels hogged the limelight for quite some time. Are you still? I know your age, and I wouldn't be so vulgar. Are you still opening the batting?
I'm playing on Saturday in a six a side at Wormsley. And I'm playing on Sunday in Victor Blank's game if my back holds out.
And where would you put yourself in the field just to make sure that you're fit for batting?
Closer than it used to be. I used to be a superb gully fielder, but you know my hand eye coordination is not as good as it used to be. So I think mid on or sort of maybe. Mid on probably is about the best position. Mid on and maybe third man or final leg is probably where it gets to now.
Very good. Rog.
Yeah, I don't have the ball following me around. It does have a tendency to do that and embarrassing me.
So Martin, you mentioned.
I must say, Jazz, I have taken some brilliant catches at the time.
Well, they would say that, I think, with some of your acquisitions as well.
only some, yeah.
Well, that's a good segue because that was what I was going to ask. You mentioned Mike McCormack and IMG, and I think I may be wrong. I think there must have been one, maybe two times in your career, Sir Martin, that you had a look at that agency.
The first time that the trustees wouldn't let us have a look at it because they said that was when Teddy Forsman bought the business. Because we were regarded as being competitive, which I thought was a thing. But then, you know, Ari Emanuel had set his heart on the second time around. Ari Emanuel had set his heart on it, on buying it. And, you know, he's, I think, done a good job on it and with it. And
But he paid too much, did he not? That was too much he paid.
Well, you know, always the people who don't get these properties always say, you know, it's like in the advertising business, if you don't win an account, you know, the people who are working on the account always say that the winning agency discounted their fees or cut their prices. I mean, it's always the sore loser thing. No, to give Ari Emanuel his due, he you know, set his heart on it to put it together with WME. You can make the argument he did, but I remember people saying that Teddy Forsman overpaid for it first time round. I don't think actually, I mean, it's interesting to speculate what I think actually Mark wanted. I mean, I knew Mark fairly well.
Yeah.
And we kept in touch. And I talked to him about this and we were investors in what Mark called Wampum, which was IMG Interactive. You know, Mark kept the equity at IMG. It's quite a funny story, really. He kept the equity at IMG very tight, i.e. himself. I mean, I did have an equity interest in IFM UK Limited, but every time IFM UK did well, the profitability sort of was like squeezing.
Transfer pricing.
It moved into another part of the empire. But he basically didn't like to give people equity in the main vehicle. And then along came IMG Interactive around the turn of the millennium. And I think it was Mary Meeker, who was an analyst, I think, at Morgan Stanley, said, you know, IMG and Bob Kraft, actually, the Kraft family were investors and WPP was an investor. And I remember Mary Meeker put a price tag on it of about $1 billion. And Mark really didn't, you know, get the digital thing. I mean, none of us got it at that time, but in particular, he didn't get it. And he regarded it as being wampum, you know, stuff that you sold because it no value to you, but might have value to the recipient. And I remember he dispersed the equity around. I think we managed to get out of IMG Interactive with our skin on, just about. We got our money back. It wasn't brilliantly successful, but I remember that time. And Mark, you know, sort of, because he couldn't really, he didn't really get it. Just disperse the equity with gay abandon. It was very funny. But, you know, it's I just think that that was just a timing thing. I mean, IMG was always worth a lot of money. And I think Mark, well, the point I was going to make was that Mark, I think the best result for Mark would have been the sale of like 20 or 40% of the company. And with his family, you know, with his kids, with his two sons and his daughter, running the business. And, you know, if I had been him, you know, and there was a funding issue. I remember talking to Mark. Mark thought about floating off the interactive business when it was being talked about as being so valuable, floating it off. I remember I had a conversation with him at the Carlton Tower about that, which was his favorite hotel and restaurant, or certainly with me it was, and saying that, you know, he'd like to sort of float it off, maybe, because to another funny story, he complained about never having enough, you know, cash, never having enough, you know, he would say to me, everybody tells me I'm worth all this money, and yet, you know, I don't have money, because he just built a house in Florida at what the Americans call Gloucester, or I can't remember exactly what we were called, Gloucester. It wasn't Gloucester or Gloucester. It was another thing like that. And I remember him saying, you know, implying that there was a bit of financial strain on building the house. And he was saying, everybody thinks I'm worth all this money, and yet I have no cash to do it. So, you know, I think, look, Ari paid probably the right price for it. He paid the market price. Maybe he overpaid a little bit in order to win it, because there were a number. I think CVC were an underbidder for it. But we missed out for both times. One, because we were regarded as being competitive, which I thought was a very unfair, and it was rigged. And then the second time, because we weren't prepared to pay what was a stiff price, but I think probably with the benefit of 2020 hindsight was justified.
Martin, we've seen the sports industry, it's one of its sort of anchor revenue sources has been sponsorship, obviously, and clearly that's been very close to media and advertising all your career. Do you think, and in fact my own career in sponsorship over the last 30 years, do you think with D2C now that sponsorship can potentially have its own golden age, where it shows true value to brands and therefore as an investable commodity, rather than maybe something that has been more of a nice to do and less quantifiable in other parts of the marketing mix?
Well, the thing that always amazed me was, you know, the basis for which sponsorship decisions were made. I mean, you know, I go back again with it's a long story, but I mean, Jackie Stewart ringing me up one day and saying, do you know Willie Purvis at HSBC? And I said, yes, I do. And he said, well, you know, he wants to get HSBC to sponsor his F1 team. And I said, look, Jackie, I think it was 7 million quid a year for 5 years or something like that. Let's say, so 30, 35 million, which in the scheme of things doesn't sound a lot of money today, but then was a lot of money.
Yeah.
I said, look, Jackie, I'm prepared to call Willie for you, because I do know him a little bit and I admire and respect him. Willie Purvis was all. Wonderful man, and built HSBC. And I said, I'm willing to do it, but I'm not prepared to tell him that he should put me. So I rang Willie, and I dutifully did. I said, Jackie has called me. He's told me to call you, and, you know, I'm calling you because, you know, I said I was going to do it. And you know, we talked about it for a few minutes, and I gave him my view. And blow me down. You know, I thought there was no way that the board of, you know, a bunch of bankers at HSBC would it, but blow me down. And people who were at the board meeting told me that William, you know, made a very impassioned speech and presentation to support Jackie. And
who was going to argue with Willie Purvis?
No, or argue, I think more importantly, jars with Jackie Stewart.
Right.
He's a master at, actually, Jackie is quite extraordinary. I mean, he has managed to negotiate and encourage people. You know, he sold his team, of course, to Ford Motor Company.
Yeah.
Reputedly for $100 million or whatever the price was. You know, he's brought some great sponsors into F1, like Heineken and Rolex. I mean, he had an association with Rolex for many, many years. So Jackie is a Jackie's a very interesting sort of answer to your question, in that, you know, he understands, you know, because most of these decisions are not, to my mind, are not factually made. They're made emotionally, because either people have an interest in it. I mean, I remember one, I won't say which company it was, but the CEO of one company saying to me, there is no way that we will ever, you know, sponsor Formula One. Forget it. There's just no way. And then blow me down, about three races later, I see the CEO in the pit in full, I won't say which team either, in full regalia. He's now retired as a CEO, actually. In full regalia, and the company as a sponsor of the team. I don't think it was an enormous amount of money, but it came from the CEO's budget. That was the other thing. It didn't come from the brand budget. But, you know, those are both interesting examples. They, you know, some time ago, but most of the decisions, sadly, are not factually based. And the reason they're not factually based is there's not enough data. There's not enough compilation and comparison of the data. And I think, you know, that's a real sort of gap in the market. Because what you have to do, I mean, the amounts of money that you're talking about are so huge. You know, look what you had to pay for top sponsorship at the Olympics or the FIFA World Cup. And I think given that, and Formula One, given the costs, you know, there has to be a much more rigorous way of doing it. And there are techniques being developed. And I think, you know, we'll start to see more of that, you know, Giles and Roger, as the sports rights prices come under more pressure, upward pressure is what I think. And as they become more significant, and as the tech companies become more and more important. I mean, I talk to the tech companies as much as I possibly can. And, you know, I will tell you, I mean, one analyst, really good analyst, Michael Nathanson, wrote an analyst report recently, must be about 2 or 3 months ago, on sports rights. And I took him to task because he never mentioned the tech companies as being potential buyers of rights. And they are going to be huge, in my view. I mean, they are going to come like there's no tomorrow. And, you know, you've already seen Amazon do it. You've already seen Facebook have a go. You Google, you know, all of them. Alibaba, Tencent, as we said, TikTok. So all those companies, you know, Apple and Microsoft, they're all going to be there. So looking at these rights and looking at the value of them and how they can get involved.
Sir Martin, on that, I was going to ask something else, but that's a segue into this. I think that is the accepted wisdom. You know, the big digital and tech players are going to come in and save sport. But
It's not save it. I mean, there's you know, sports is one of the ways, probably one of the major ways, or the major way, of connecting emotionally with consumers. And so this is not, you know, this is not a question of saving things or whatever. I mean, obviously COVID, you know, I remember we were talking to, I was talking to somebody about Serie A in Italy, and the guy I was talking to knew a lot about Serie A and football, saying that all of the clubs, you know, were facing bankruptcy. And then you see what happened on Roma. There are people willing to look through COVID,
yes,
and think,
yes,
about it coming out the other side and what it's going to look like, and willing to make big investments or bets on that.
The point I was going to make was this, and you've said yourself that one of the problems with sport is the opaque governance and conflicts of interest. So here's what I think the difficulty is with the big global, because I think that's the word, tech players. When they want to do something, they want to do it for the globe, the world entirely. Whereas sport, it's democracy, in inverted commas, democracy, is set around geographical lines and supranational organs of power. I'm talking FIFA, IOC. And I think that is incredibly difficult to sit together. And, you know, when I keep thinking about, you know, what is going to happen when Apple gets their act together, when Google decides what it wants to do, I think they're going to come against the fact and say, I don't want to have to deal with 52 national associations, and I think I just have to knock the whole house of cards down.
Well, I disagree. I mean, I think you know, there are three events that are global, right? There are the Olympics, there is the World Cup, and there's F1. I mean, if you're the president or prime minister of a country, and Bernie used to make this pitch, you know, he would go and see the president or the prime minister and say, if you want to change the image of your country, it'll cost you $200 million to build, you know, a track or whatever, and you're not going to get a return. He was actually very forthright. I mean,
sure,
I never saw him sort of do this as a face to face, but I heard reports from him and others, and he would say it's going to cost you $200 million to build the track, but you will put your country, your city, or whatever it is, on the map. I disagree with you. There are three clearly global, and I think, you know, without going into detail, I think you're going to be surprised by the changes. You know, you think about soccer. When soccer, you know, when we've had the Olympics and the World Cup in America, I think it will take things to another level. Hopefully, when things settle down post-COVID, I think it will take things to another level. And I think there are these global events that have global impact and that are really attractive to global brands. I think what is, you know, what the, and what you said, I think there are some geographical variations. You know, if you think about what's going to happen to the Champions League here in Europe, that obviously is a European event, but there are plenty of rumors at the moment about what may or may not is going to happen to the Champions, which is a knockout competition, and whether you might have some form of league competition in Europe in addition to the Premier League or the Serie A or La Liga or whatever it happens to be. And I think we're all going to be surprised by what's going to happen in those sort of areas. I'm surprised by the appeal, the commercial opportunity, the rights values. There will be some consolidation, and COVID, you know, there's a Darwinian culling taking place, or that will take place in sport, just like it's taking place in every other area of the economy or government. But I think it will be ultimately, it'll be very difficult, but ultimately for the better.
Martin, you talked about the big three global events of F1, Olympics, yeah, World Cup. And do you think, I've heard it said that the Olympics is flying on vapor, and that its appeal in terms of the product, in terms of the sports that are thrown up, are not necessarily embracing the young. And they've obviously done some changes with the Winter Olympics and Snowcross and other variants. With the governance of the IOC, which is a little bit unique and maybe wouldn't be invented today, coupled with the fact that sports and young people and their consumption is changing, do you think it needs a radical overhaul, or do you think it's been going in some form or another in ancient Olympia for a long time? Do you think it'll ride this out?
Well, I think Thomas Bach has made a very big difference. I mean, I think the president of the IOC, I mean, he inherited a not an easy situation. I think you probably, to be fair, I mean, people may disagree with this, you see more change at the IOC than you have maybe at some other, without naming names, at some other similar institutions.
In Zurich.
And maybe, well, I'll leave you to figure that one out.
Yeah.
Maybe there's more to come. I think that probably will be the case, because, you know, whether it's Zurich or wherever it is, I think the people running these organizations understand change. But, you know, what you're saying, Giles, is no different to the struggles that at WPP. You know, I mean, I think about my last few years at WPP, or, you know, I watch the new management there struggle with it, and it is a struggle. You know, they have legacy assets. So, you know, the good news is it's the Olympics. The bad news is it's the Olympics, in the sense that, you know, it's been around for a long period of time, and it has an established way of doing it. And trying to change it is not easy, and when if you change it too fast, you destroy. You change it too slowly, you get hammered. So it's very difficult balancing act, I think, Giles, actually. I think it's easy to criticize from the sidelines, but when you've got a, you know, it's like the difference between WPP and S4. I mean, WPP, you know, is not making progress, simple. What's the reason? It's weighed down. It has an albatross around its neck, which is the traditional, you know, I was just reading a circular today from Redburn, which, you know, pulverizes all the established holding companies. And the stocks are off today, but, you know, WPP is off 5 or 6%. So, and I guess it's on the back of this circular. So it's the fact that they have legacy assets, and we live in a world which, coming back to those tech companies that you decry a little bit, or maybe not even a little bit, you know, saving the industry. They're not going to save the industry, Roger. They're sensible people. They will invest where they think they can get a return.
They will invest. They will indeed. Yeah. No, you're right. You know, like Giles knows I'm a big fan of that. But listen, I want to say something about WPP, because for a year I was inside it dealing with the Benatti stuff in Italy. And I have to say, Sir Martin, I don't think it's a surprise that since you left, and I'm not just saying this, that organization only held together through the force of your character. Because there was just too much politics and too many egos. And I want to come on to
That's because you were in Italy, and there's always politics and egos. I mean, I was reading this wonderful article. It was in Graydon Carter's Airmail. It was last weekend, about how Silvio Berlusconi, at the age of whatever it is, 88 or whatever it is,
yeah,
you know, has a shot at being the kingmaker again. I mean, Forza Italia only owns a very small part of the political market, but he's potentially a kingmaker again.
Yes. But I'm not.
Journalist said he's made of Teflon.
Yes, but I'm not going to let you get away from this question, because I think it is a good one. Now, WPP and its efforts in sport, I think, because. Well, I've got my opinion. I want to ask yours. It never really got it right, did it, Sir Martin? Even when at the end you did ESP, I would argue you did it right with George Pine, but why did all over the years and at the end ESP, why did it not manage to show all the promise that it had and just couldn't deliver it?
Oh, no, that's painting everything with a brush, Roger, which you are prone to do. That's not fair. Yeah, Media Pro, yeah, we owned, trying to remember what was the ownership we had in Media Pro before they sold control to the Chinese.
About 20%, I think?
No, I think we had more than that. I think we had 40. But, you know, Thatcher Bennett, who's still running it with his Catalonian colleagues, you know, that they were super people. I mean, they managed to get themselves into lots of scrapes, let me put it like that. But they always emerged, you know, it's like a pig in the proverbial. They always emerged from it smelling of roses. And they're super too, and they're still, you know, very active. They are really, really, really good at what they do. We had that. We did a lot of work for the Olympics. We did a little bit of work for FIFA. We did a little bit of work for Formula One. You know, I think part of the answer to your question is we never had, you know, 100%. And, you know, obviously I have a different view. The fourth element of S4, as I explained, is a unitary structure. And I think, you know, when you refer to egos and me keeping it together, if you like, I mean, obviously I knew, and with a number of others, I mean, quite an interesting thing happened over the weekend. You know, Mark Reed made these comments about ageist thing, right? And I think it does have a problem with older people. I mean, I'm going to be very forthright, and I think he does.
But he was your man, Sir Martin. He was your man. No, but
he believes that one of the ways that you will, you know, sort of save WPP is by getting rid of all the old people. That's what he believes, I think.
Wow.
And he may deny that, and that might be a very controversial thing to say on your podcast. But, you know, if you look at, you know, the Ford account, which was run by Satish Corday, who's, you know, he spent his life on Ford.
Yeah.
And to jettison somebody like that, you know, let's say for a minute, you know, without personalizing, let's say the individual, you know, wasn't in touch with the new realities, let's put it like that. These people have so much experience and so much knowledge. They know where the bodies are buried. To jettison them doesn't make any sense. You know, you throw the baby.
I agree.
Yeah, I mean, it's a bad analogy. Obviously, you throw the baby out with the bathwater. And it's a mistake because, you know, the corporate knowledge and the corporate history and understanding the nuts and bolts is very important. And if you just go through, you know, a swathe of people in the way that they're doing there, and they fired 5,000 people in the first half, and probably by the end of the year we'll fire another 5,000. You lose a lot of the corporate memory, and mm-hmm. that's valuable. It's not, mm-hmm. you know, you can't just say that's old. You know, I'm 75, and you know, maybe this is the COVID era. You know, don't forget that with COVID policy, the herd immunity, I'm in the vulnerable, and you know, I was dispensable with. I mean, when the government in this country started off, when they weren't doing lockdowns, what they were betting on was, you know, so a few old people die a little bit faster. You know, that's...
No, that is, yeah.
We're the expendables, right? So it's a bit the same in corporate. And I do think, you know, to be... This is a harsh thing to say, but I'll say it. I do think that he... And that the reason for that comment, which drew all the criticism on the weekend, was because there is a belief that history and experience and age... There's something negative about it. There is some ageism there. And I think the reaction was right in some respects.
Talking of young people, are you a bull or bear on esports?
Coming back to, you know, sport, don't devalue the value of these institutions, because these institutions do have tremendous value and skills and ability, and you're in danger, again, it's a bad analogy with it, with an ageism point, but throwing out the baby with the bathwater. Sorry, Giles.
But I think, Sir Martin, that is actually the core of this podcast, because the three of us very much believe in the value of the traditional sport, certainly in Europe, where it has grown up over all that those hundreds of years. But it has to change. And we question both sides of it. And sometimes we'll take the view that, you know, we don't want to embrace the change and the 1.7 seconds of attention time that I read on your website.
Yeah.
And sometimes we want to go back and say, well, you know, Test cricket was beautiful and the MCC is the greatest institution in the world. And I think that's the core, as you've articulated there, what we are trying to do on this pod.
Well, and what we saw with Jerry Cardinale when he came on the show, someone I know you'll know well, is what's interesting is with Redbird Capital and obviously the announcements they've made of investing into sport, as they will be doing and are doing straight away, is what we were very edified with was that Jerry takes a sportsman's view about the traditions and the history and the heritage of sport, as well as being an investor. Because if you get it wrong, as you say, the 5-year window that private equity would normally take for sport means that could be curtains for many sport because there's no longevity. At the same time, if you don't have revenue investment, there could be trouble ahead. So fascinating times. I wanted to talk very quickly about esports because of young people. And I think of the three of us, I'm definitely the youngest. So I'm obviously closest to the esport generation.
That's no honour on this.
It's a low bar.
It is particularly, it's the only half century I'm ever going to make in my life next year is age. but where are you in terms of with your clients and so on? Are you a bull or a bear on esports?
Very bullish. I mean, just take Bob Kraft. He bought, I think, the New England franchise or the Northeastern US franchise from Bobby Kotick at Activision. You know, Activision launched Activision Blizzard launched, I think, an auction for the esports rights. This is several years ago, and I think Bob Kraft bought it. And I think he's a visionary in this area. Again, I would single him out as being the most accomplished in the way that he's built the Patriots franchise, the soccer franchise he has, and on esports, I think he was one of the first in. So I, using him as a model or as a master, if you like, I think he's right on the money. And I think esports, we're seeing it. We could all argue about whether it's healthy and what does it do for young people stuck in front of a screen all day or whatever it happens to be. We can argue about that, but that is a fact of life. And we can do some things about that. But coming back to what you're saying about the IOC, one of the things I forgot to say is that Thomas Bach has surveyed what sports should be included in the IOC, whether it's summer or winter, and he has made very significant adjustments because they're not dummies. They understand all the things that you understand about youth and change and digital and everything, and they're trying to adapt the model as rapidly as they possibly can. I think esports, big growth area, big growth area. And obviously gaming and betting. I mean, was it today I saw on CNBC that, link up with CNBC, I think it was, with sports betting. So we're obviously gaming, COVID-19 is a pressure cooker, or I call it a sort of almost like an activist investor. It's pushing people to accelerate digital disruption and digital transformation. And the in-home entertainment and gaming industry has got a huge boost from COVID-19. And that's going to be, so all that change has been concertinaed in the last 6 months. So esports, yes. I mean, I'd be very bullish, and we would encourage clients to take a position.
Last question, Sir Martin, coming back to the Holy Trinity of S4 now, content, media buying and programmatic, and data. We see this week, we see the really innovative link between content and Amazon with the Spurs All or Nothing, where they've created their own. And you know where I'm going with this question. Surely Amazon, of all of the Fremenies, if you will, is the one most positioned to bring the Holy Trinity together.
Yeah, I mean, all of them are. I mean, Google and Facebook. I mean, it's not, the other thing is, first thing to say is that, Google and Facebook have not caused problems for the ad hold companies. The ad hold companies, of course, been caused problems because basically their client base, after 2008, when GDP growth was slower in nominal terms than before because there was very little inflation. I mean, look at the Fed. The Fed last week, at Jackson Hole say, well, rates are going to stay lower longer because,
we're going to let it run hot.
Countenance 2% inflation. Well,
yeah.
We haven't had 2% inflation for many, many years. So, So what's happened is that, companies have put pressure on their ad hold companies. Google, Facebook, Amazon, I am sure that there are people at Amazon or Google or Facebook who have different views. But I think basically, I view them as partners for us. We're a very junior partner. We're a tiny company in comparison. But we're trying to understand how they operate. And I mentioned 20 or so companies. We're trying to understand how all those companies operate. And then we can advise our clients about where they distribute their budgets between the hardware, the software, and the platforms. There are three.
Mm-hmm.
Those 20 companies are hardware companies, they're software companies, and their platforms. And how do we advise our clients to navigate their way? So you could all describe all of them as frenemy. I mean, everybody's a frenemy because they invade some of your territory. They help you in another part of the operation. So you could put it that way. But, Amazon, I agree. I mean, Amazon has, the second most valuable. I mean, Saudi Aramco probably is in between. I haven't checked recently, but in between Apple, which is now $2.25 trillion and is more as of today, is worth more than the Russell Index, all the small companies in America put together. It's quite extraordinary. So then Apple is the number two of the tech players. And I agree. I mean, they are formidable. And I've got to tell you one thing about Amazon is, despite the fact it's the second or third most valuable company on the planet, they move like greased lightning. If you give them an idea or a thought, which they like, they will move on it in 10 seconds. So you remember what I said about faster, better, cheaper? Faster is about agility. Yeah. They have agility. And most of the tech companies do. And that's the big issue. And coming back to what we were talking about, you know, about all these institutions in sport, you know, the good news is we have our reputation and our history. And the bad news is we have a reputation and history.
But yes.
It prevents you from pivoting as rapidly, particularly in a COVID. Huh? And we don't know yet what impact COVID will have. You know, because of the furloughing here in the UK, we won't know until the end of October, you know, what the bankruptcies are going to be. I mean, I don't know. I don't know whether you have done work on this yourselves, trying to estimate. I think it'd be an interesting thing to do, because there's bound to be more consolidation. Bound to be, in my view.
Yeah, I just think I agree with you. I think it's a bit of a phony war moment now in terms of furloughing. And I agree with that completely. And I think the worst is still to come. And it's going to coincide with the American election and a Brexit negotiation.
Exactly.
And I think it's going to be very, very difficult. And of course, that means that sport is going to struggle. And then the ultimate question is who finances it? I won't use the phrase again, saves it. Who finances it going forward? And it's interesting when you see that some of the key financiers like 23 Capital went bust this week, and you wonder who's going to fill that working capital gap. So a really amazing and interesting time, Sir Martin.
All right. So we shall see. Maybe we should have another podcast in about 6 months' time just to reflect on what we talked about here and how wrong we all were.
Would love to. Love to, sir. Thank you so much for your time. A real delight.
Martin, thank you very much for your time. Lovely to see you as well.
I think we probably will have caused some trouble.
Yes, I marked that thing about Mark Greed. That's what we call in the content business a sound bomb. That one is marked.
Okay. All right.
Take care.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, Jailo, that was a real pleasure for me. I can't say how much I'm grateful for you organizing that and how much of a great guest he was. I thought he was very open.
Well, what I've been so delighted about this podcast and our listeners giving us the feedback that they do is that many people are using this as a kind of form of education and a masterclass. And clearly the people who are doing that is the quality of the guests.
Yeah,
and to have someone like Jerry Cardinale on the show is clearly very fascinating, particularly with the US perspective. To have Sir Martin Sorrell is, again, someone of the same caliber that has seen the industry from all ends all over the world. And I think particularly as he looks ahead, as we are all looking ahead to what is the casualty list from the pandemic and so on, sport's got a really interesting journey ahead. We've talked about it. We'll absolutely follow up on his kind self-invitation. He will join us in 6 months' time. And let's have a review on the sports industry, which I suspect will be going down a path that will be, it feels like a hurricane path, and there will be those that stay and those that sadly don't.
Yes, wonderful. Nothing more to add to that. And we will do that in 6 months' time. Amazing period for us all to be in. We didn't touch on a lot of the stuff we thought we could get into, but, you know, what a wonderful interview. So all that remains really is to thank everybody, thank our sponsor, Pump Jack Dataworks, for providing us with this opportunity and this guest, and thanking the listeners. And if anybody wants to rate and review the podcast, you know how to do that. It's very important, especially if you want to get our profile up to get us able to get more guests like this. You can find the podcast on Entertained R, that's the word R.
And you can find me, Giles Morgan, at Giles Morgan 71.
And you can find myself at RPM Como, as in the lake.
as in the lake.
Take care. To the next time.
To the next time. Thank you.
Thank you.